TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness. The War on Freedom, How and Why America Was Attacked on September 11. An interview with the author, Nafees Mossadegh Ahmed, Part 2. Nafees Ahmed begins his book, The War on Freedom, with a quote from a study by the former National Security Advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski. Brzezinski spoke as early as 1997 about U.S. plans for a war on Afghanistan. Brzezinski also said that there was a need for an external threat to make the American public go along with a militarized U.S. foreign policy. In his book, Ahmed suggests that the events of 9/11 were the event that the U.S. administration needed, and he raises the question, what did the Bush administration know about the preparation of the 9/11 attack, and when did they know it? In part one of this program, Nafees Ahmed asks why, unprecedented in U.S. aviation history, no Air Force planes were sent up to intercept the hijacked planes, and why one of the few planes that was allowed to fly after 9/11 was a plane that gathered up the members of the Bin Laden family to fly them out of the country. Nafees Ahmed is the executive director of the British-based Institute for Policy Development Research. His book is the most comprehensive effort yet to explore the many strange, suspicious, and inexplicable occurrences that took place in the United States and around the world in the days, months, and decade leading up to the attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. Today's program begins with a close-up view of the so-called lead hijacker, Mohammed Atta. Atta, as it turns out, had close connections to high-ranking members of the Pakistani Intelligence Service, who in turn had close connections to the CIA. Although Atta was on the U.S. State Department terrorist watch list for many years, he was allowed to go in and out of the country even with an expired visa. Here is Nafees Ahmed, reached by phone in his home in England. He comments first on Mohammed Atta.
Mohammed Atta, he'd been on the terrorist watch list, State Department watch list, since 1986, according to the San Francisco Chronicle. He had been known as a terrorist, and at that time he had been implicated in the bombing of a bus in Israel. So it wasn't like this guy was just operating out of the blue. You know, he had been known to the State Department, he had been known to U.S. intelligence as someone who you had to worry about, who had a record of terrorist activity, and who should not be allowed into the United States. But despite that, he received his visa. And he managed to enter into the United States and leave the United States and travel everywhere many, many times, which in itself is extremely, extremely hard to explain as anything else except someone in the State Department deliberately allowing a terrorist, a known terrorist, inside the country, at least in my view. And what makes this picture worse is that we had a report from various sources which said that Mohammed Atta and several other people were actually trained at U.S. military bases in the 1990s. Not just Mohammed Atta, it was also many other hijackers who were involved in the September 11 attacks who were also trained at these facilities. And which brings up the question of how could someone who is a known terrorist get a visa to enter in the United States and then be allowed to train at a U.S. military facility as a known terrorist? It doesn't really make much sense unless Mohammed Atta was a part of some kind of U.S. military intelligence or government operation to do with anything. Could have been something mundane even, but he was definitely involved in various covert operations which had some kind of government approval and which involved military training.
Is it known where he trained?
Yeah, there was it was Knight Ridder News Service which provided the specific details. Mohammed Atta attended the International Officer School at Maxwell Air Force Base, which is in Montgomery, And there are many. The other hijackers were Abdulaziz Al-Omari, and he had attended the Aerospace Medical School at Brooks Air Force Base in Texas. And the other guy who's been named is Said Al-Ghamdi, and he had went to he studied at the Defense Language Institute in Monterey, California. I think there were at least two other hijackers who trained at a different Air Force base. I mean, Newsweek reported that three hijackers were trained at Pensacola Naval Station in Florida. We don't have names of who those people were. It's worth noting that there has been some dispute in the press over whether the people who trained in these facilities really were the hijackers or whether they just had the same name. And I'd like to go into that just a little bit. There's an investigative journalist who used to be with NBC called Daniel Hopsicker. He actually called up the press office of the U.S. Air Force base that had trained Mohammed Atta. And he'd asked the spokesperson there that about this whole issue of Mohammed Atta. And the spokesperson there said, well, we're not sure if this guy whose name we've got down here really is Mohammed Atta the hijacker, because there are various biographical discrepancies. It wasn't just with Mohammed Atta. I mean, the guy was basically saying that there's all of these hijackers, there's biographical discrepancies. And so Hopsicker said to him, what about Mohammed Atta specifically? Are there biographical discrepancies specifically with him? There was no comment. And Hopsicker pressed and pressed and pressed. And in the end, the guy admitted that, okay, Atta did train here, but we can't say anything else. And so we've got it on the record that Atta certainly did train there, and that based on the obstructions of these spokespersons at these military facilities, because all of them have refused to disclose the real biographies, the specific discrepancies which supposedly have existed between these various people, to prove their point, it does suggest that those discrepancies don't exist. They were the same people. They are the same people, and that's a point which I think is worth remembering in order to investigate the matter properly. And specifically, it's interesting to note that Mohammed Atta was, as the chief hijacker, he was the guy who received $100,000 in funding from the Pakistani intelligence service. The order was given by General Mahmoud Ahmed, who's head of the Pakistani intelligence, the order to wire $100,000 to Mohammed Atta. The guy who carried out the order is a guy called Ahmed Omar Sheikh. And Ahmed Omar Sheikh, he's another known guy, a guy who's had a long record of terrorist activity. He was involved in 1993, 1994, hijacking planes, who amongst the people hijacked were British citizens and American citizens. And he has been known again to the United States and the British government for many years. And it's worth noting in relation to this whole thing that there was a report in the Pittsburgh Tribune Review quoting Pakistani government officials, who basically said that they believed that Ahmed Omar Sheikh was not just connected to the Pakistani intelligence, but was also connected to the CIA, and that they believed he was on the CIA payroll as an informant. Now, when we close the circle here, here we have Atta, chief hijacker, who himself seems to have some kind of very dubious connections to the U.S. military, who is a known terrorist but is still allowed inside the country despite that, and is still doing military training despite that. We have Ahmed Omar Sheikh, who is apparently, reportedly, according to Pakistani government who know the guy, is on the CIA payroll, who gives Atta the $100,000, who wires the money. And we have the guy who gives the order, who in some sense oversees this financial transaction, this funding of terrorism, is General Mahmoud Ahmed, who is the head of the Pakistani intelligence service, which is also, very, very close to the U.S. intelligence and military services. And so when we put these things together, we really have to think that there is something very strange going on, at the very least. And the possibility that the U.S. government or elements of the U.S. government, if not the entire government, elements of the U.S. Military intelligence infrastructure may have been in some way involved in what happened on September 11th.
All right. Let's go on to the put options. There was a stock speculation on American and United Airlines stock as well as Morgan Stanley just preceding the 9/11 attack. Can you comment on that?
Michael Rupert is the guy who has really, I think, done the best job in breaking this story. He's a former LAPD narcotics detective who publishes his newsletter From the Wilderness, and it was From the Wilderness that first basically revealed the implications of the fact that there were massive put options placed on put options and stock options placed in relation to very specific stocks on American Airlines, stocks on United Airlines, stocks on firms which have very huge offices rented in the World Trade Center, such as Morgan Stanley, and other firms as well, which have a very large placement in the World Trade Center. And these options were placed literally a few days prior to the September 11th attacks. And essentially, a put option is basically like a bet that the value of a stock is going to drastically fall, and because you've made that bet, you'll make money out of it. So that's a very crude way of describing how it works. But essentially, it showed very clearly that there were various people who were in the financial community who anticipated that some kind of crisis was going to hit the airlines, was going to hit the World Trade Center, and was going to crash their stocks so badly that they were going to make a huge profit out of it. And it was going to happen within September, mid-September, in the next few days. In other words, they had advanced warning of an imminent crisis. And what makes this all the worse is that the CIA uses a software called Promise Software. It's PROMIS. This software is very, very technical, very, very specialized, and it's used by the CIA to monitor stock trading in real time. And there was the journalist who works with Michael Rupert, I can't remember his name now, he did a series on this whole issue, and he phoned up the CIA, and he asked one of the people there, the CIA spokesperson was called Tom Crispell, and he asked him about, you know, does the CIA use Promise software? Can you tell me? And the Crispell basically confirmed that the CIA only uses Promise software outside the United States. They cannot use it in the United States because it's illegal. But the fact is, the CIA uses Promise software to monitor international stock trading around the world. And this means that if the CIA was using Promise software, was monitoring stock trading, and it's worth noting that there are other mechanisms, civilian mechanisms, which do monitor stock trading as well. For example, there's the Financial Services Authority in London. There's an international surveillance system called Echelon, a satellite system which also monitors financial transactions in extreme detail. So there are many mechanisms which are available to the financial community, available to the intelligence community, which monitor these things, which does suggest that the CIA, that the intelligence community, should have had advanced warning of an imminent crisis that was going to hit the airlines, that was going to hit the World Trade Center, and that some measures should have been taken, therefore, in order to prevent what was going to happen, especially in light of the fact that, as we know very, very well, that as of June, July onwards, the CIA and the U.S. intelligence community was waiting for an imminent terrorist strike from Osama bin Laden. And if we accept the official line, they didn't have specifics at that time. I don't believe that. But even if we accept the official line, they didn't have specifics. They knew that there was going to be a terrorist threat. And this information that would have arisen literally a few days prior to September 11th, based on analysis of the put options, etc., would have showed very clearly that something very, very strange was going to happen and they needed to act. But they didn't act. There is actually corroboration. There are reports suggesting that the intelligence community did have advanced warning and knew that there was, that actually had this information, and it was fairly widespread. In various reports in the New York Times and Washington Post and other sources, which came out about a few months ago, there was a case of a stock advisor, a U.S. stock advisor, but I think he's based in New York, who actually sold a whole load of stock on 10th September, one day before the attacks, something like several hundred thousand dollars worth. He just sold it all. And the firm at which he worked, there was a guy there who was either the firm at which he worked or the firm which was involved in the sale of the stock. There was a guy who had been working there, who had been aware of the transaction, and after September 11th realized or speculated that there may have been a connection, that this guy was selling his stock the day before, and he's managed to escape a crisis that happened the next day. What if he was involved? And so this guy called the FBI and said, I'm worried that this guy might have been involved in some way, you know. I thought I'd better tell you. And the FBI investigated, and they discovered that there was this whole several years' worth of corrupt activities by this stock advisor in connection to various former and active FBI officials. For several years, this guy had been using information that he had been obtaining from his contacts in the FBI to actually place, to make money, essentially. For example, his contacts in the FBI would give him information about investigations into corruption in various corporations. This stock advisor would use that information. He would leak it in order to damage the credibility of a corporation and then make a profit out of the results by selling the stock that he had bought in advance or various things like that. Essentially, it was a very corrupt relationship he had established, a long-term relationship with his FBI contacts. And it's worth noting that given that fact, what he did on 10th September seems to have been as a result, again, of this long-term relationship he'd established with people in the FBI, connected to the FBI, who seemed to have had advanced warning of something that was going to happen on 11th September, and who therefore seemed to have advised him that, you know, you can do this and you can make a profit and we can probably get a share, I don't know. And I think this whole situation, this whole report is very, very interesting. Because there was a person who was involved in the U.S. government investigation, and he was involved in prosecuting this guy, actually said before the court that he believed this guy had specific advanced warning of the September 11th attacks. And I don't believe that he actually may have known himself. I would think that most probably his contacts knew, his contacts in the FBI knew, and they had simply told him, and that there is a CIA connection and an intelligence connection to this whole thing. It is further corroborated by the fact that following the financial trail, the put options for the vast majority of them were placed, can be traced back to a bank, which used to be headed by the CIA executive director, Buzzy Congar, that's his name. And once we connect these pieces together, it's very clear that there is this matrix of various different intelligence connections from the CIA and the FBI, and it certainly needs to be investigated.
What are your hopes and expectations of any of this ever seeing the light, given that the Commission of Inquiry hasn't yet been constituted, and first Kissinger was named to head it, and now he has resigned from it?
I don't believe, to be honest, that there is really any hope with the Commission of Inquiry, which is being set up by the Congress. It seems to me that the congressional inquiry is constantly being co-opted in some way by the powers that be, which is inevitable because the Congress, of course, is within that matrix of power. And so it would be, to a vast extent, manipulated as much as possible by the administration. And that is what, that's what we see happening. I mean, the whole appointment of Kissinger to head the commission is itself an illustration of how ridiculous and how co-opted the commission is, that President Bush could appoint a guy who is essentially a war criminal, you know, and this has been documented by such people as Christopher Hitchens, who is a fairly respected writer, professor, and journalist. And to have a war criminal such as Kissinger, who is heavily involved, has been heavily involved in covert operations, for example, in relation to Chile, who has been involved in supporting human rights abuses, supporting war crimes, and protecting dictators, etc., etc. To have someone like that appointed to a commission to investigate the September 11 attacks, attacks which, in many ways, seem to have been facilitated by various U.S. government agencies and officials of those agencies, you know, it really does. It really just is. It's ironic, at the very least, to have someone like Kissinger in charge of such an investigation. I think the fact that Kissinger resigned from his position in the light of what was almost a small public outcry that you could appoint this guy to do this really does show that how bad things have got, that we can actually imagine this guy being appointed. I mean, I would never have imagined. It would have been a joke to me that, oh, imagine if Kissinger was voted to be on the Commission of Inquiry. You would never have imagined it even happening. The fact that it can happen really does show we have a problem here, that the American people are not involved in the process of investigating September 11th. And I think that they should stop expecting Congress to do it, because Congress is very weak. It's the very nature of our political systems that our members of the British Parliament, members of the American Congress, they want to stay in power. They want to win their elections. And to do that, they want to make friends with the powers that be. And they don't, and in many ways, they want to toe the line. They don't want to say anything which is too controversial. They don't want to sound unpatriotic, etc., etc. And so we cannot really expect them to be extremely pioneering in criticizing the government. People need to stop expecting things of people who are in power and actually start doing things for themselves. We have various movements, very small movements, which are breaking out. People's moves are breaking out in different parts of the United States. And they're small only because they're disconnected. And there's groups such as Unanswered Questions, www.unansweredquestions.org, headed by Kyle Hentz. There's groups such as the People's Investigation of 9/11, which Carol Brulier is heavily involved in. There's many different organizations and movements which are springing up, asking questions, saying we need to have an independent inquiry into September 11th. I think we really need to unite these multiple groups across the United States who are calling for an investigation into 9/11. That they need to establish a common agenda that we want an investigation, an open investigation, investigation into everything that happened, without any prejudices, without any biases, without any kind of standpoint where we won't look into this, but we will look into this, or we will look into this, and we want to focus on a particular conclusion. No, we just want to look at the facts, at what happened. Why did the World Trade Center collapse? We just want to know, why did it collapse? There hasn't been an inquiry, let's find out. It doesn't matter whether the government was involved or not involved. We want to know, you know, was there negligence? Was there not enough fire safety equipment? You know, what happened? Because we don't have any answers to these questions. And these questions need to be asked across the board. You know, why was there failure of air defense? Why was there such a failure in the intelligence community? And those questions, if we look into those factually, the answers, they may be shocking. We may not like them, but we need to look at them factually and just assess everything we have. And once we've established that this common agenda that we just want to have answers and we don't want to bias our answers, we just want to know the truth. And then we can bring these groups together under this common agenda, and we can collectively, you know, get the American people involved, and literally just all the members of these groups just have this massive election. They can propose candidates to sit on the board, you know, people who are going to you know, various respected people who have openly said that they are interested in having an inquiry and who are interested in being involved in the investigation, in being involved in the independent commission. And we can literally vote for them. We can propose candidates. We can approach them and say, would you like to be a candidate? There are professors, there are academics, there are journalists, there are former government officials, there are people in the Air Force. There are so many people who are interested and who are calling for an inquiry. We just propose them together, sort of find some system of selecting particular candidates and then have a massive vote amongst all these organizations and get the commission going like that. We cannot stand around waiting for the powers that be to carry on muddling away, basically just forestalling a real investigation. We need to do it, and we can do it, and we need to set up something credible, which is made out of credible people. There are people like that who want to know the truth and who want an investigation. We don't want the facts to come out 50 years' time or 100 years' time when some guy writes a big encyclopedic book on the subject and, you know, and then it's a few historians read it and that's the end of it. We want it to come out now, and we want it to come out so that we can change things. We can change things in the United States. We can change things in the United Kingdom. We can change things around the world to make the world a better place, to make the world a place where we can live and not be worried about terrorism, where everyone can actually have what they deserve and live in justice. And to do that, we need to say, let's have an investigation, look at these issues, and organize ourselves.
That was a conversation with Nafees Ahmed, author of the recently published book, The War on Freedom. The publisher is Tree of Life Publications in Joshua Tree, California. I hope you have a pen handy to take down a phone number. You can find more information on the War on Freedom on TUC Radio's website, www.tucradio.org. That's tucradio.org. Look under Newest Programs. You can get information how to order a copy of this program on the War on Freedom by calling us. TUC Radio is listener-supported and free to all radio stations. Your tape order helps us stay on the air. Call us toll-free anytime at 877-TUC-TAPE for information on how to order. You can get your tape by mail or credit card, by phone or on the web. Our toll-free phone number 877-TUC-TAPE translates into 877-882-8273. Time of Useful Consciousness is an aeronautical term. The time between the beginning of oxygen deficiency and the loss of consciousness. Time for the pilot to save the plane. My name is Maria Gelarden. Thank you for listening. Give us a call.